Hey, Johnny, just give me a countdown when you're ready to start the show. But you know, like last week, I was already on the air and you didn't tell me, and that was really embarrassing. So don't, what?
Ron Van Dam is an experienced talk show host. Do not attempt to try this at home.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Yeah, just let me know when we're on the air, Johnny. Okay?
Whatever.
What, John? Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the... What is this, Johnny? What's the name of the show, Johnny?
Back, relax, grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, whatever your liquid libation may be in the morning, and join us as we take a look at the world around us. As much as it's a pleasure to be with you, the pleasure is actually all yours. And now, here's your host, Ron Van Dam.
Thank you very much, Julie. Welcome to the program. There is nobody here named Johnny. I was kidding. No, really? You mean that was one of your funny bits, Ron? Yeah, that's fine. That's what it was. Welcome to the program. How are you doing? Good to be with you on this fine day. What a wonderful, wonderful day this is. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I have no idea. I do this show in the mornings. I don't know when you're listening to this. And to be honest with you, it doesn't really matter. But I do this show very early in the morning. So this is the first thing I do when I wake up. Well, not the first thing I do when I wake up. I go to the bathroom like immediately because I really have to go badly. And then I brush my teeth and I bathe a little bit, you know, and get dressed, put some clothes on, whatever, whoever clothes is nearby. And then I come into the studio here and I sit down and I do this show. So this is the beginning of my day. And it's invigorating in a sense because it gets my brain going. And I think you need that. I've never in my life used a snooze alarm because I think they're dangerous. I think snooze alarms kill. Snooze alarms are basically your body and your entire spiritual being saying, I'm too lazy to live right now. That's not a good thing, man. In the morning, you should feel invigorated and have a really good meal full of carbs and sugars. So that you can start the day fat. I was told that if you eat a heavy breakfast, then you have all day to work it off. That's stupid. Because you can't work that stuff off. It doesn't come off you. You know, people that, and you watch these TV and these diet shows, and you buy this piece of equipment, you can burn like 100 calories, 200 calories. Yeah, that's really wonderful. Problem is, you're eating like 2,000 calories for breakfast. Breakfast is a very strange thing. It's centered around the egg. And thank God for you chickens. It's centered around the egg. And the egg can be prepared in many different ways, man. You can just take the egg and kind of almost eat it naked. You just you crack it, you put it in a fry pan, and it's kind of looking up at you through the whole meal. It's like this big cyclops orange eye looking at you, kind of like the president-elect or whatever he is. It's staring at you, especially if you have two eggs sunny side up. And the sunny side would be the egg, by the way, the yolk. It just stares at you through the whole thing. But it's not the egg itself. There's protein in there and a hell of a lot of cholesterol. But it's not so much that. It's what you have with the egg. And you just think about that. Thank God for the chicken to the point where you can eat the egg. Then you've got to get down on your knees and pray to the pig. No, I'm not talking about her. I'm talking about praying to the animal, the pig. Without the pig, we wouldn't have breakfast. The pig is responsible for so much stuff. The pig is responsible for sausage. Sausage. Who came up with this? Let's take a pig, grind it up, the face and the beak and whatever the pigs have, the snout, you name it, the paws, whatever you call those things. Ground it all up, man. Why waste anything? Ground it up, and then let's shove it inside of intestines. Sounds like a great food idea to me. What? Who came up with this? Who came up with this idea? The Germans. The people in Eastern Europe. I think they want to kill society. They're mashing up animals and stuffing them in intestines. And then we're eating them for breakfast. As if that weren't bad enough, the pig is also responsible for the ham. Do you ever have ham? Of course you've had ham. Ham goes with the breakfast as well. For some reason in our society, we can't eat ham unless it's very heavily salted. Have you ever had a piece of ham that wasn't salty? I have not. What would ham taste like if it didn't have salt, sodium thrown into it? I don't know. I have no idea. I've never had it. I've never just chewed on a pig before. I don't know what that would be like. Okay, maybe. All right, so we got the sausage. We got the ham. That's not where it stops. We're missing the big kahuna itself, and that's the slab of bacon. Bacon! Bacon started as a breakfast thing. Now they're making bacon ice cream. You can put bacon on your potatoes. Bacon all over the place. Bacon, 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 bacon. Sure, I love the taste of bacon, but I also realize every time I eat bacon, I'm one step closer to death. Ugh, ugh. The fat, the oozing, dripping fat and grease of the bacon. And yet, let's start the day with that. Hey, how about starting the day with that? Yeah, it's nice. That's nice. So that's the pig contributes major, major. What else do we have for breakfast that's healthy for us? Let's see. Well, we can take some flour and just a lot of carb crap, and we can make pancakes. Pancakes have absolutely no nutritional value whatsoever. They actually don't exist in nature. They have absolutely nothing going for them at all. They just will make you fat, lazy, there's just no point to pancakes. Here's what we do to them, though. Because there's no point to them whatsoever, we make it even more of a no point, and we pour blind syrup, which is liquid sugar, all over the stuff that has no value whatsoever. A great breakfast choice, again, to start your day. What do we have with that? Let's see. And of course, the pancakes and the waffles, they're all in the same category. The bread, the potatoes as well. Starch. It's all starch. Starch, grease, and fat. That's the way you start your day. Doesn't matter, Ron. You can burn it off through the entire day. Yeah. No, I can't. Unless you're a stripper and you're constantly in motion, that's not going to happen. What else do we have with our breakfast in the morning? Let's see. How about a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice? That's not such a bad idea. The problem is, if you've never had acid reflux, now you will. Orange juice is very acidic. Do you know what acid does to things? It burns holes in things. I'm not saying every time you drink a glass of orange juice, you're burning a hole in your esophagus. But probably day after day, week after week, year after year, it's probably not great. Why don't you just eat an entire can of Comet? What's the difference? What else do we have for breakfast that makes it wonderful? Well, of course there's fruit, but nobody really has it. It's always the option. Aranda, you should be having some fruit in the morning to start your day. That sounds wonderful. Now I won't have it. Nobody eats fruit in the morning, except for people that really, 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 really think about this. Normally, people don't do that. What do we drink? We drink coffee. What's coffee? It's bean juice. I've talked about this before. I don't understand the fascination in this country or in countries around the world, especially South America, of this coffee thing. And in the United States, our coffee is fairly weak. It's fairly watered down. It's quite mild. In other countries, this coffee is like, take a handful of dirt, put it in your mouth, and swallow with a glass of water, because that's pretty much as close to coffee as you're going to get. That's real coffee. Juan Valdez, he's dead. Guess why? And it's not from riding a mule in the mountains. It's from drinking this crap. Breakfast is a wonderful, wonderful meal. That's how we start our day. We start with crap. Then we get a little bit more conscious of our food for lunchtime. Used to be people used to eat bologna and cheese sandwiches for lunch. That was it. That's all you could eat. That was the law. Now people for lunch, they eat salads. What happened to us as a society? I think we got so guilty about either having stupid breakfast or not breakfast at all, we decided that at lunchtime, we better clean this up just a bit. So we have salads. And some people are very good with the salads, you know, not so bad. Other people can't have salad without poppy seed dressing, which is like 5,000 calories per teaspoon. But at least we're trying to be good about it. And we'll put a little chicken on the salad, the chicken that's left over from the egg thing. And for dinner, that's a rough one, man. That's rough. Dinner is a matter of where you're at for the day. If you had a sucky, horrible day, you're not going to sit down and have a well-balanced meal with starch, vegetable, and protein. You're not into that crap. You want a slice of pizza or a hot dog. Let's face it, that's what you want for dinner. And in the summer, it's what you have for dinner. It's amazing that we're able to walk the earth. We should be extinct like the dinosaurs by now, but we're not. I don't know. I don't know how we exist. Then you go to the doctor like once every year, and the doctor says, you know, you've gained a little bit of weight. And your response is, well, that's okay, because I'm not eating well. At least there's a reason for this. Yeah, there's a reason. So, as I've said so many times, this year, I'm changing my lifestyle. I'm not going to eat all that crap for breakfast. Even oatmeal, that's like just full of oats. That's, might as well be a horse. I mean, what is it that I should be eating on a regular basis? What should I be eating? And then I realized, kale and spinach. I'm not eating enough kale and spinach. Everybody says I should be eating kale and spinach. Sounds like a horrible comedy team. I'm going out Saturday night. I'm going to go down to the club. Oh, really? What comedians are down there? Kale and spinach. Very, very funny people. Healthy and very funny. Kale and spinach have one thing in common. Well, there are two things in common, actually. They're both green. And the other thing is they both taste like you're eating grass. But, you know, it's good for you. All the stuff that's good for you is not going to taste good. It's good for you, but it's not good tasting. You can't have both. That's impossible. If something was really good for you and good tasting, this world would be a different place. We'd all look pretty good. Look in the mirror. It's not what it's at. It's not what it's about. It's a miracle that we're still here. When my mother, when I was being brought up as a small child, which is what most people do when they're young, being brought up as a small child. You don't want to be brought up as an adult. That would be weird. My mother cooked in lard, Crisco. I don't understand it. I used to eat cereals, sugar frosted flakes, sugar pops, sugar smacks, tasty, wonderful cereals. Another great breakfast idea to start your day with sugar. That'll get you going. By 10 o'clock, you'll be crashing. Cereal with sugar and coffee. I don't know how we make it. Everything my mother cooked in had lard in it and sugar. And it's just a miracle that I'm still here today. I don't know how, I don't know why, but I live and breathe, my friends, at least for now. Miracles, man. Yeah, it's a miracle we're all here. It's a miracle that the sun comes up every morning. Actually, it doesn't come up. It kind of is always there, but stupid people think it comes up. It's sunrise and sunset. Well, that refers to what it does over the horizon. We're like, we're spinning, man. The sun just kind of stays where it is, pretty much. Just for your information, just in case you didn't know that. There's some people that think that the earth is still flat. I can't, I know who they voted for in the last election. Those people, the basket of those people. Anyway, speaking of miracles, we're going to speak to a doctor right now. And I know I need a psychologist. I'm not talking about that kind of doctor. Here's a miracle, man. Did you know that at children's hospitals all over the country, and this doctor is affiliated with Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, which is an incredible place, they actually do surgery many times a week on fetuses, little tiny freaking fetuses. How small are your tools? I mean, you got to wear glasses for this, and I assume you can't drink alcohol ever. What a delicate, how can you possibly operate on a fetus? He does this. I got to talk to him. Dr. Scott Adzik joins us now. He's the surgeon in chief at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I believe we've spoken before. We're talking about birth defects. Apparently, one in every 33 babies is born with a birth defect. That's significant. I didn't know it was that prominent.
Well, this is a good topic to discuss because this is National Birth Defects Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And so when you look at the statistics, one in every 33 babies is born with a birth defect. So it's common as a group. Birth defects are costly. Billions of dollars are required for medical treatment. Birth defects are merciless. No parent is immune. They're mysterious. Most causes of birth defects are unknown. In my view, they're overlooked. Research is underfunded. And most importantly, birth defects are deadly, the leading cause of infant mortality. So in the U.S., each year, nearly 150,000 babies are born with birth defects. Mm-hmm. Many with conditions so rare, most parents and even some clinicians have never heard of them. So too often these families aren't made aware of the treatments available at a place like our Center for Fetal Diagnosis and Treatment at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And the parents are left feeling overwhelmed with few options. So we're going to solve that by talking today.
I've talked about this before, and I am always floored and amazed that there is even such a thing as fetal surgery. Because, as I understand it, a fetus is quite tiny and quite delicate and not exactly like right in front of you on an operating table. So I still fail to understand how this is even possible.
Well, we have a saying around here that there should be a trademark for it. It's we do small.
Mm-hmm.
So what a fetal surgery operation involves, so for instance, this week, we did one on Monday, one on Wednesday, and then a patient tomorrow. Fetal surgery for spina bifida is one of the most common things we do. So what does that involve? Well, you mentioned, to give you sort of a word picture, the mother, who's at about 23, 24 weeks gestation, where term is 37 to 40 weeks, so about midway through the pregnancy, goes to sleep under general anesthesia.
Right.
That also anesthetizes the fetus through the placenta.
Uh-huh.
We prepare her abdomen and make a sideways wound in the lower part of the abdomen to expose the uterus.
Uh-huh.
We use sterile intraoperative ultrasound to look at the fetal position and to map where the placenta is, which is the crucial hookup between the baby and the mother because right. we want to avoid that.
Right.
We use a uterine stapling device that makes a wound in the uterus full thickness and keeps the membranes tacked up against the muscle layer of the uterus. And we use this uterine stapler that quickly and bloodlessly opens the uterus.
Uh-huh.
For spina bifida, we have the fetus positioned so we only see the back and the fetus remains inside
right.
the uterus during the operation. We don't actually take the baby out.
Uh-huh.
Then we do the repair. And we do the repair to prevent ongoing damage to the exposed nerves with spina bifida, because spina bifida occurs when the tissues around the spinal cord don't form properly.
Mm.
And particularly during the third trimester, those nerves are damaged by amniotic fluid, which is basically fetal urine. Fetal urine is not good for your spinal cord. So that defect is repaired, and then we close the uterus watertight and close the maternal abdomen and then give the mother medications to minimize the risk of preterm labor. And then for that pregnancy, she needs to have a cesarean section when the time
right,
comes.
Right.
Point is to protect those nerves, to enhance the baby's chances to walk, and to minimize the risk, which is the usual scenario
right.
with treatment after birth, requiring a shunt tube to treat hydrocephalus or fluid on the brain.
What is the success rate, as far as you know, on this operation?
Well, we know a lot about spina bifida because we've done many, many cases and have actually done in the past a randomized prospective trial. So we can give accurate statistics to parents about what the success rate is in terms of trying to avert those deleterious effects. Spina bifida, though, is not truly a life or death sort of birth
mm-hmm.
defect, whereas other birth defects such as lung tumors that cause heart failure or high-grade urinary tract obstruction that develops that destroys the developing kidneys or
mm-hmm.
twin-twin transfusion syndrome, which we very successfully treat to save both twins by fetoscopy, a minimally invasive technique, those success rates are quite high.
Huh.
And now I'm old enough so that we now have patients who are 15, 20, 25 years of age, and it's very gratifying to see so many children who as babies likely could have died now running around and growing
yeah.
up healthy and strong.
Yeah. So if it were not a question of time, would it be safer to do it on the fetus or after the baby is immediately born?
Well, so that goes to the crux. It goes to sort of the mm-hmm. nexus. We only do the operation before birth because we have to, because
uh-huh.
if we waited, for example, with life-threatening birth defects, when the baby was born, we would be too late. The end organ damage would already be done, and
uh-huh.
the baby would die. So
okay.
the point is to intervene before that end organ damage occurs.
Okay. So it is a matter of time then, okay.
It's all a matter of timing, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Everything you're saying, I'm just floored by it. The future of fetal surgery, how is that headed? What things do we have to look forward to?
Well, there's a whole list of things that we treat before birth now,
mm-hmm.
And we do more and more as the word spreads,
mm-hmm.
And it's an option for families. This year at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia will do about 150 to 200 fetal surgery operations,
wow.
which of course is many more than even a few years ago.
Yeah.
The future, though, is going to be probably fetal cellular therapy and gene therapy. For example, we're poised to begin a
wow.
clinical trial soon to treat sickle cell anemia before birth, which can be diagnosed by 6 to 10 weeks gestation in high-risk families.
Mm-hmm.
And the treatment would be to give normal bone marrow cells by injection to the affected fetus. Those normal cells would then produce normal red blood cells and replace the defective functioning of the sickle cell red blood cells. These cells would be given early in gestation at 12 to 14 weeks. They would engraft because the fetus at that gestational age doesn't have an immune system
right.
to reject those cells.
Right.
And then
cool.
Then you'd end up with a cure.
Right.
The same sort of thinking is true for other cellular deficiency diseases. And we're also doing work, and this is all research experimentally, in fetal gene therapy. And I think we're at the same stage now with fetal gene therapy. Imagine being able to treat, say, cystic fibrosis with gene therapy before birth with
right.
cure. I mean, that would be wonderful. So we're at the same stage now with concepts of fetal gene therapy as we were with anatomic
right.
defects when we first started to think about repairing them 25,
right.
30 years ago.
And all this would be supplied by the mother's marrow and the mother's cells, I would assume, which would be an exact match.
Well, the match isn't important, though.
That's true, because it's not rejected anyway.
But the match isn't important because the immune system won't reject the adult cells.
Interesting. Well, we could talk for hours, but don't think I'm supposed to. So instead, I'll ask you where we can get more information.
The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, or CHOP, website's good. It would be fetalsurgery.chop, CHOP.edu. So fetalsurgery.chop.edu.
Oh, great. I mean, you know, to families that are suffering and scared and against the wall, places like the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and surgeons like yourself are godlike. And I know you probably don't like that term accordingly, but you know how you impact people's lives. So thank you for that. Thank you for your service. And pleasure speaking to you, Doctor.
Always a pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow. Phenomenal, man. That's just phenomenal stuff. I still can't wrap my brain around that. How's that possible? How's that possible? I can't ever imagine being a surgeon like that. I do not have the discipline. I would be, what if you feel like sneezing or something and you're in the middle of a fetal? I can't. I mean, he's like a hero to me, man. How do you do that? How do you operate on a fetus? You got to have some really good prescription glasses or some good tools. I don't think the tools are like a Home Depot thing. I think you have to get them like from a surgical supply place. I think it's incredible. Wow. It's a miracle. It's a miracle, man. He is the miracle man. That's what he is. He's the miracle man.
Here comes the miracle. The one we've been waiting for. Here comes the miracle. It's time to open up the door. Heart is beating fast. I can't seem to slow it down. It's too late to turn back, but it's not too late to turn. Open up the door. Why am I shivering? I can feel it fading fast. Well, for the first time I believe that I can finally
miracle. Here comes the miracle. You want to talk about a guy who's got his mojo working? It's this guy right here, Ron Van Dam. That's why they named the show after him, 100% Mojo.
How you doing, huh? That was a miracle. That was by Cheap Trick. I had plenty of those when I was a young adult, if you know what I mean. Sheesh. Woo. We're going to talk to another guest right now, if I may. Can I? Is it all right? This place astounds me. I've been to it once before. But it's not nearby. It's in Washington, D.C., and you kind of have to go there to be there. But it's an incredible place. It's a museum, but it's a newsium. It's a museum of news from the past and the present. It's quite an incredible place, and Patty Rule is here to tell us about it. They change their exhibits every once in a while. They got something pretty cool right now going on. Hi, Patty. How are you?
I'm doing well, Ron. How about yourself?
I'm doing very, very well. Patty Rule is the Director of Exhibit Development at the Newseum, one of my favorite places to go whenever I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. It's great. They change your how frequently do you change your exhibits there, by the way?
Well, last year we had 7 new exhibits. This year, little bit of a less hectic pace, but we're really excited about Louder Than Words, Rock, Power, and Politics.
Yes. Now, what exactly is that about? I'm confused. It seems like a lot of things rolled into one.
It is a lot of things rolled into one. It explores the intersection of rock music and free expression and the political and social movements that have shaped our modern times, you know, from civil rights to Black Lives Matter, from women's rights, gender equality, war and peace, all of the issues that have really shaped modern time and how musicians played a role in changing the way people think about those things.
That's interesting. Did you find in the piece there that you have rock and music that affects society as much as society affects rock music?
Interesting question. You know, we kind of have both things. You know, we talk about you know, the various songs from, you know, Bob Dylan, The Times They Are Changing, right, to Kendrick Lamar's All Right, and how those have been experienced by people. Mm-hmm. And we also talk about censorship and the pushback that artists receive. Yeah. You remember in the 1980s when Dee Snider of Twisted Sister and John Denver have to, you know, testify before Congress about a movement to label lyrics because people were uncomfortable with some of the things that rock musicians were talking about. So we talk about all aspects of that.
And I understand this exhibit has been seen before other place.
Yes, we did this in a partnership with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum in Cleveland, and they opened it last summer during the Republican National Convention. It was a big hit there, and so we're thrilled as we're about to inaugurate a new president that we're going to have it here at the museum starting this Friday.
Hmm, interesting. I'm not going to say anything about that.
Okay.
Oh, all right then.
Free expression, free speech.
It is, yes, but not when I'm doing an interview. Anyway.
Okay,
fine. Do some of the exhibits become permanent at a point because they were so popular?
Well, we have permanent collections, permanent exhibits here. We have 8 sections of the Berlin Wall. That's a permanent gallery. We have our Pulitzer Prize photographs gallery, and that's permanent. This, unfortunately, isn't going to be permanent because a lot of the artifacts are on loan from the artists or from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Museum. But we hope perhaps it will travel. So people have, you know, several months to come here in D.C. and see this amazing exhibit with 164 artifacts, including the guitar that Jimi Hendrix played at Woodstock, the T-shirt and jeans that Bruce Springsteen wore on the cover of the Born in the USA album, Madonna's jewelry. I could go on.
Does it have Kim Kardashian's butt?
Well, that's all, it does not.
That has nothing to do with
music.
I don't
think she's a rock musician yet, but maybe that's a future career move for her.
That's the only thing she hasn't been yet, unsuccessfully. okay, yeah, this is so these items, many of them are on loan, and they go back to the artists when this tour is over?
Some, well, I won't say many of them. Some of them are on loan from the artists. Some of them are from the collection of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, and some of them are the museum's artifacts, too, from our collection. So we have a variety of sources for the incredible artifacts that we have on display.
Right. Now, you mentioned the presidential thing and the atmosphere there. Is it possible that the president-elect, I refuse to say his name, would actually be stopping by the museum?
Well, it's possible. We haven't heard that he is coming by, and you usually get a little bit of a hint that that's going to happen with the Secret Service coming through. But he'd certainly be welcome to come here. You know, our mission at the museum is to champion, explain, and promote the five freedoms of the First Amendment and free expression.
Right.
So anybody is welcome to come here, and we'd certainly welcome a visit from the president-elect.
Even the president-elect. Now,
even the president-elect. The First Amendment applies to everybody.
Okay. All right. I wish he felt that way. Anyway, okay. So now what is your favorite artifact on display?
That's tough. I mean, I love Bruce Springsteen, and I also am a writer, so I love seeing, you know, Bob Dylan's handwritten lyrics to The Times They Are Changing. When you get that sort of early kernel of, you know, what connects between an idea that an artist has and then putting those ideas down into pencil and paper to create a song that has resonated for generations, that's really powerful to me. We also have costumes from the Village People, a group that, kind of grew out of the disco era and brought, you know, the gay rights questions and issues into the mainstream. So pretty much every major social movement of the past 50 years is somehow reflected in this exhibit.
You know what I wish, Patty, is that someday with virtual reality, I'd be able to be there without being there, because not everybody lives in Washington, D.C., although if you ever go to Washington, D.C., you must, it's required, go to the museum. It's an incredible place. It's fairly new in the scheme of museums in Washington. Most of them are quite old. But this is a fascinating, very up to date yet historical place. But for those that can't get there, is there some way to enjoy it? Will there be?
Well, you know, we are working on virtual reality. It's funny that you mentioned that, because we've got a gallery where we showcase the best in virtual reality, where people can kind of put the goggles on and experience that sort of new way of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And we're working on other aspects of that. You can go to our website, museum.org. We have traveling shows, Creating Camelot, and the Pulitzer Prize photographs. So lots of ways you can experience the museum. We also have incredible educational materials that are available free online for teachers and students to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. At museum.org. So lots of ways you can experience the museum, but we'd love for people to come here and see us on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C.
Sure. Now, as your director of exhibit development, I'm going to ask you questions that I guess I'm not supposed to ask you, and that is, what's in store for us next time around?
Next time around, let's see. We're working on an exhibit with Pictures of the Year International that'll come into play next year, and that's one of the oldest and most respected photojournalism contests. We have an exhibit that we're opening in February about the civil rights movement of 1967. We kind of celebrate 50th anniversary years of the civil rights movement, and that talks about the rise of black power. Really interesting and provocative exhibit coming up there. So that's what's coming up next at the museum.
Yeah.
But there's always something new here.
What, as you go through the museum and you see people gathering, what is the one in your permanent exhibits, what is in your mind the one that most people flock to and are most astounded by?
Well, we have 8 sections of the Berlin Wall, which people are really surprised to see here in Washington, D.C., and that tells the powerful story about how free expression and the free exchange of ideas led to that wall going up in the first place to kind of prevent that from happening, and then led to it coming down in 1989.
Yeah.
We also have all of the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographs since they began handing out the award in 1942.
Oh, cool.
We have a section of the antenna that was on top of the World Trade Center in our 9/11 gallery.
Wow.
So we have 500 years of news history in our news history gallery from the beginning of the printing press to today. So all kinds of really exciting and provocative things to see and do here. We have a be a TV reporter section where you can stand up behind the microphone and, mm-hmm. and try to be a TV reporter and what that's all about. So all kinds of films to see here in our 15 galleries and 15 theaters, mm-hmm. 7 levels here on Pennsylvania Avenue, halfway between the White House and Capitol Hill.
Wow. That's got to be the number one museum in the world as far as I'm concerned. It sounds fascinating. It's actually a museum that I would go to, believe me.
please come on down. I'd be happy to give you a tour.
I'm not good at museums because I get very, very antsy, but this just sounds, everything sounds good. All right, so how do I find out how to get there, all that kind of stuff, if I wanted to contact the museum?
You can go to newseum.org, and that's N-E-W-S-E-U-M as in Mary.org, and all the information about ticketing and when the exhibit's here and other things that are happening here at the museum is all available there online.
Okay, it's the Newseum Museum, but we call it Newseum because it is new, and it's about news and the news of today and yesterday. Thank you so much for your time today, Patty. Always a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Nice woman, isn't she? Isn't she a nice woman? She does a great job over there. She really does. I'm very impressed with her. I think she's really wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, we're just about out of time for today, and I'm sorry to say that, but things have to end here today. I'll be back again next time, the next weekday that you encounter. I will be here again. Until then, I wish you peace. Bye. See you now. Later, bye. Are we off the air? Is that it? Are you sure we're off the air?